Hi, welcome to Strange Fruit. I'm Kyla.
And I'm Jay.
And today we are going to concentrate our juicy fruit topic on the recent incident last weekend. A Kansas City Chiefs player, Javon Belcher, shot and killed his girlfriend, Cassandra Perkins, before driving to a Chiefs training facility and killing himself. And a lot of the reaction on Facebook and on Twitter and via social networking has been this idea of victim blaming as opposed to talking about him as a perpetrator of violence, as a batterer, as an entitled, violent partner.
For example, folks have been trying to make sense of it by saying
she wasn't responding to text messages.
Or she went to the Trey Songz concert or are really kind of trying to figure out what it is that she did to drive him.
And so, yes, instead of looking at him as a perpetrator of violence or some type of enraged, controlling bully, which obviously he was, right? Saying that it was about concussions and this, when there's no medical evidence yet to even prove that, really negating the, all of the recent findings around past abuse and control issues in the relationship. So we had the fortune of being able to talk to Gina McCauley about her recent blog.
Yeah, so in a second, we're going to check in with Gina and find out about the piece that she wrote on this situation. But I do want to talk a bit more about this and how this relates to, for example, victim blaming. And this has been mirrored in all segments of our population, from women who've been the victims of sexual abuse, kind of, what were you wearing? Why are you out so late at night? Why'd you have so much to drink? Certainly a few years ago, when you and I went through a situation with a gay bar in town, and we were... I was called the N-word and we were, you were called the B-word. And we were kind of kicked out and folks were saying, well, what did you all do to warrant, being called the N-word and the B-word? And so folks oftentimes, in the same way with the Elmo situation, we spoke a couple weeks ago about the dude who plays Elmo being accused of sexual misconduct with some young boys, some underage boys rather. And so folks are like, well, the supposed victims, what did they do wrong? Or they're, they were money hungry. Or so folks have a tendency to look to victim blame. Talk. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and I think that both, and then later in the show, we are going to talk to Aisha Simmons about her documentary, No, the Rape documentary. And Gina and Aisha both really, almost resoundingly so, argued that it is hard, especially within communities of color, to think about the idea of a perpetrator or a perpetrator of violence being someone who looks like us and lives on our block, on our neighborhood, in our house. And that when it comes to domestic violence, intimate partner violence, rape, and sexual assault, these are the only crimes, and then also gay bashing and these types of things. These are the only crimes where the survivors of these crimes, if they do survive, are the ones that are blamed for the crime. So if I go to the ATM at 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm robbed, are people going to say, well, why were you at the ATM at 3 o'clock in the morning? Or are they going to be having sympathy because I'm, because I got robbed? Right. Mm-hmm. But the our measures of sympathy and empathy. And what I particularly enjoyed about Gina's interview is that she talked about how this typically happens because Black women, Black girls and women are really socialized around this idea of being these strong, independent women and having no fragility, no vulnerability. And so that when crime does happen to them, if they are murdered or beat or violated, that somehow they are responsible for that. They did something, they said something, they didn't do or didn't say something. And these are the only times where we are always focusing in and around what the survivor or the murder victim has done to warrant, as opposed to looking at how we are, how we structure intimate relationships. I mean, and all these other types of ways, misogyny, sexism, none of that is a part of the conversation.
It kind of brings to mind the whole topic around how not to get raped versus how not to be a rapist.
So, yes.
For example, girls first time going to college, they always tell women and girls, this is how you avoid getting raped. And the conversation very rarely goes to men, and this is how not to be a rapist. So so to make some sense of this story, we spoke with blogger Gina McCauley. And Gina wrote a piece for her blog, What About Our Daughters, called The Crucifixion of Cassandra Perkins, Victim Blaming, Black Maternal Homicide, and Stupidity.
I'm Gina. I'm a Black woman, and I'm a cyber crusading warrior princess.
I love that. Oh my goodness. I love Cyber Crusading Warrior Princess. I love that. Could you just talk to our listeners about what your main point was in writing this particular blog?
Yes, I've been covering violence against black women, extreme violence against black women for over 5 years. And the coverage of our case isn't anything novel or new. We have a pattern in this country, especially when women are involved in intimate partner violence, of examining the woman's behavior in the man's decision to beat her up or kill her. And my philosophy is that the person responsible for violence and the person completely and totally responsible for violence is the perpetrator. There should be no examination of what the victim did at all, especially if you're in a case of an unarmed woman being shot 9 times. And I knew almost immediately, and I saw it happen in my Twitter feed, on Facebook, people began to try to figure out what she'd done to cause him to kill her. Now, that may not have been at the forefront of their minds, but the way in which the crime was described, the way in which she was described, the way in which people began to theorize as to what caused her to be murdered, all surrounded victim blaming. And I've written a number of times, if you go to the blog, about the perfect black girl victim, which is that we as a black community will not have any sympathy for any black woman that may have had any imperfection whatsoever. There's always an examination before we decide whether or not we're going to have sympathy or empathy as to what the woman or girl was doing before she was raped or tortured or killed. And so this was a case where people were doing the same thing. They were talking about, well, she went to a concert. She shouldn't have been out.
She didn't respond to text messages. I heard that, and I was like, what?
Yeah, I mean, crazy stuff. There were even people on Twitter saying, well, she must have told him that the baby wasn't his. It is all of this stuff, and I'm just like, no, the obvious answer is that he was a violent, murderous bully. And then that was the Twitter reaction. And then the mainstream media got started, and they started to walk down the path of NFL concussions. And I was just like, hold up, wait a minute. There's been no autopsy. There's been no indication that he was suffering from these effects prior to this. Why are we going out of our way to ignore the fact that the reason this woman was murdered is because of misogyny and sexism? She was murdered because he wanted to control her in some way. He couldn't, and so he killed her. And instead of stepping up and accepting responsibility and going to jail for the rest of his life for being executed, he decided to go commit suicide and make his baby an orphan twice over. So I wrote that post because I was disgusted by the fact that we were examining anything about this young woman's behavior prior to her death, because she bears zero responsibility for him pulling the trigger 9 times. I don't care what the argument was. It didn't need to end in that way. He chose for it to end that way. He is completely and totally responsible. I'm disgusted by the fact that people are telling him to rest in peace. We don't want to talk about misogyny. We don't want to talk about sexism. We don't want to talk about how athletes treat women and how women fit into that whole world and what role that may have played in it. I mean, this is not the first post I've written disgusted with the coverage of violence against women. But what also happened with this post, and I think the reason it went viral, is because I pulled up some stats from some writing that I had done like 2 or 3 years ago for Essence Magazine about black maternal homicide. And race has to be introduced when you have a stat that says black women between 25 and 29 are 11 times more likely to die while pregnant or within a year of their murders, and then black women overall are 7 times more likely to be murdered while pregnant or within a year of giving birth. Because that's ridiculous. Those are extreme statistics. So there's something systemic going on that doesn't have anything to do with concussions or Trey Songz concerts. that people don't want to examine. And even now, I mean, we're almost a week in, and I haven't seen one article about black maternal homicide in mainstream media.
I know, and I love that. I was just about to talk about the statistics that you cite. Black women have a maternal homicide risk, according to the CDC, about 7 times that of white women. Black women ages 25 to 29 are 11 times more likely than white women in that age group to be murdered while pregnant or a year after childbirth. I mean, that those are some stark statistics. And,
yeah.
You know, and the thing I really liked about your blog is that you're really arguing that this is not somehow this individual case. This is something that is systemic, that it is part of a larger issue. When I heard about it, I heard immediately after I heard about the incident from someone who was telling me, they followed it up with, well, you know, severe concussions and this, that, and the third. And I'm like, concussions?
And look, traumatic brain injuries do affect impulse control. They do affect behavior. They can lead people to violent outbursts. But the problem is, you know, they are now learning that he's had incidents of violence in the past with women. And so to me, for them to jump to concussions, I'm like, how do we skip over all of these horses to go looking for a zebra, as they say in the medical profession? You go looking for this absurd possibility when, in your face, this is an intimate partner violence case. And I don't want to belittle traumatic brain injuries. They're horrific. But there's no evidence that that's what happened in this case.
Now, before this, we have another famous, really highlighted situation of intimate partner violence between Rihanna and Chris Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And what's also interesting is that now there are all of these rumors as if they're back together. But I remember when the story came out, when the photos came out of Rihanna's face, I remember that the reaction from a lot of, in particular, black women in my courses and some of my students felt as if we should, you know, somehow accept Chris Brown's apology, or he was sorry, or that, again, just like in the case of Cassandra Perkins, that somehow it was Rihanna's fault. I heard all types of rumors about she lied to him, or he saw text messages, or some type of infidelity. But again, it became the resounding conversation surrounding her being battered was how it was her fault,
mm-hmm.
how he's a young boy and he didn't know better, although he grew up in a house where his mother was battered, as Rihanna grew up in a house where her mother was battered, right? And there's no conversation around both of these kids basically coming from battered households either. It was just that it was Rihanna's fault and Chris Brown is sorry. I mean, what were your thoughts about that?
Here's the problem. You shouldn't be surprised that black women and girls are expressing these sentiments. What I figured out after 5 years of blogging this stuff is that black women are socialized to protect black males and coddle them because we are raised that they're endangered, which means we're not. The second thing, we are raised with the delusion that if we are independent and all-powerful, nothing bad will happen to us. So if something happens to a black woman or girl, it's her fault. And part of that is because we don't want to feel vulnerable and acknowledge the fact that sometimes things happen to us that are bad due to no fault of our own. So if we see another black woman who's experienced something traumatic, well, we have to say, well, it's something she did because I don't want to think that that could happen to me. And I'm living my life this way, and so that can never happen to me because I don't dress the way she dresses. I don't walk down the street the way she walks down the street. I don't cheat on my boyfriend. I don't let men text message me, all this other stuff. And then the third is that in the black community, every institution in the black community values the preservation of young black men at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't throw him under the bus. We can't criticize him. We can't cheer on law enforcement as they drag him off to jail because it would be a tragedy for the whole community. And the collateral damage, and I think that's my theme over the past 5 years, is black women and girls can't be collateral damage in this. In your perpetual race war, sexism and racism are equally vile and equally as destructive, and you cannot have a just cause while ignoring one type of oppression in order to try to triumph over another. So, you know, there's an old saying, you know, all men are black, all women are white, and which means that we ignore the fact that, yes, we are black, But we are also women who experience oppression within our community. And so a lot of that's a defense mechanism, is that we don't have sympathy for other women and girls, because to have sympathy for her is to acknowledge it can happen to us. And we get raised that if we do certain things a certain way, nothing bad will ever touch us.
Yeah. And we also spoke with on the show a friend to the show, Aisha Simmons, who did Know the Rape documentary. And in our conversation with her around violence and communities of color, she was saying how in a lot of ways communities of color can't acknowledge the idea that our perpetrators of violence within our communities look just like us, and that familiarity. And it sounds like you're speaking to the same thing, the preservation of all things masculine and male because they're endangered. Yeah, I mean, even my students will say, like, I want to have a boy. I don't want to have no girl. You know, girls is hard. Boys is, it's like, what? I mean, it's absurd, you know. And and she was saying how it's not only misogyny and sexism that does this and that creates this socialized message, but also the consequences and effects of racism. So could you talk about the consequences and effects of living in a racist society, and then also articulating that some black males are violent, right?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't write about racism on my blog at all, and that's intentional.
Okay.
And the reason I don't write about it is because if spaceships came and beamed up every white person on the planet Earth and took them off to Mars, we would still be catching pure unholy hell in this country. So my point is, there are millions of people that can come on the show and talk about racism and its impact. And of course, racism has made things worse. But our problem is, we don't talk about sexism at all in the black community.
I agree.
We have PhDs in racism. In fact, we have college programs in racism. We can't even get people. I have people leaving comments on the blog. They don't even want to acknowledge the possibility that black men benefit from and participate in the oppression of black women.
Oh, I agree. And they always say, my students will always say that, well, black men, they don't have any power. They don't have power like white men. And I say, they have power in their communities, in their homes, and in their intimate relationships. That's power to me. And that's, to be honest, that's the power that actually matters to people of color. People don't care. You know what I'm saying? People of color ain't worried about a lot of things higher up so much as they're worried about in their own household, on their block, on their street, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, there's, you know, I put that statistic up about maternal homicide in the black community. But when you talk about non-fatal violence, no other group of women has a rate that equals the rate of violence in men. Black women and black men have equal rates of non-fatal violence. You know, we're just as likely to get beat up as they are. And no other group are the numbers the same. I mean, and there's just some horrific trends. There's a book called, I think it's Getting Played, and it's by Jody Miller. And she talks about violence in the lives of, like, 14-year-old black girls in the inner city. And she follows this group of kids and interviews them. And it's the lives that they live are horrific. I mean, it's something you would expect to see in the third world, and it's happening in the neighborhood across the tracks in your city, and it's happening in young black girls. And here's it, ultimately the message I want to send. The black community is never going to progress as long as the people who are giving birth to and raising its children are catching hell. I don't even understand how people think that we're going to have progress and be a healthy community when we're ignoring what we're doing to black women and girls, and we're ignoring misogyny, and we're ignoring, you know, violence and all of this other stuff. I don't understand how people think that it's progress to, quote, not air our dirty laundry, because people are mad that I pointed out the fact that we're more likely to die while pregnant. You know, you're making it seem like black men are this. I'm not making it seem like anything. I'm telling you what's happening. And so the next question needs to be, how do we as a community address that? How do we make those statistics better?
Mm-hmm.
And people don't want to have that conversation, and we certainly don't want to have that at an institutional level.
Aisha Simmons is an activist filmmaker based in Philadelphia. She also directed Know, the rape documentary.
I self-identify as a black feminist lesbian cultural worker.
I really wanted to ask you, I don't know if some of our listeners have heard about your phenomenal documentary, No, the Rape documentary.
Yeah.
In which you explore the myriad of ways that Black women in particular have resisted and also struggled with and survived rape and sexual violence. Could you speak a little bit about how you came upon this project and why you wanted to do it?
Yes. First, let me just say I'm a survivor of incest and rape. Mm-hmm. Now, when I started working on No in the early 90s, I didn't think that the film had anything to do with me. I wanted to help all those Black women out there. But, you know, and through making No, I really saved my own life. So I started working on the documentary because I was tired of the silence in our community, the Black community, around intra-racial sexual violence. Now, I want to say that all communities are silent, so it's not like the African-American community is unique to any other community. But just given how much we have historically, you know, voiced issues around racism and white supremacy and its impact on our lives, as well we should, I wanted to say that we also have to deal with patriarchy, misogyny, and violence against women. Mm. So I started working on the film in 1994, and it was completed. It had its world premiere in 2006 at the Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles.
Oh, yes. And can you speak a little bit to the different and unique experiences in talking and interviewing the women and how the intersection of race and gender really played a part in their distinct form of silence?
Because of the impact of racism on all of our lives as Black people, there's definitely this understanding based on lived experiences of a distrust, understandably, of the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know about just how Black men are just being railroaded into the prison industrial complex, and Black women are the fastest growing population. Mm-hmm. So who do you call if you've been sexually assaulted? And, you know, the documentary moves from enslavement of African people through present day. So, you know, who do you call in 1964 Mississippi if you've been sexually assaulted?
Right.
You know, who are you calling at the turn of the century, of the 20th century, if you've been sexually assaulted? Mm. So for me, I wanted to kind of look at these realities that Black women were dealing with while fighting side by side with Black men against racial violence and for racial equality. So really, in terms of looking at how Black women stand at the intersections of race and gender and sexuality, if they're queer, and what does that mean? And most of the women, except for one, did not report their rapes. They did not report the rapes. I mean, all of the sexual assaults featured in No are, most of them are acquaintance rapes. Mm. And then the only person who reported the rape was where somebody broke into her home. And I think that that's really a strong statement on how much silence there is in our community. I mean, for many of these women, they knew their perpetrators. They were their comrades. They were their friends. They were their lovers. They were professors. I mean, so what does it mean in terms of that type of betrayal that you experience? In many of the situations, they were struggling with their the people who violated their bodies to fight against racism, either in the academy, in Black power movements, in churches. So it's so for me, I really wanted to kind of have us unpack that and look at that. And equally as important, it was very important to have Black men who are working towards ending violence against women mm-hmm. be very visible and present in the film, because we're not going to end heterosexual-based gendered violence if men don't step up and take this issue. So I really wanted audience members to hear from Black men who are doing this radical and transformational work in partnership with Black women who've been doing it for centuries.
I'd love to have you weigh in on something that is similar to what we're already discussing, but is a hot topic in the news. So with the No documentary, you talk about rape and its effect on women. But I would love to have you weigh in. Here recently, the case of Kevin Clash, the gentleman that plays Elmo, you have Bishop Eddie Long, mm. you have Jerry Sandusky. I'd like to maybe examine, officially, unofficially, sort of the situation where you have Black and brown queer boys So again, it may be different than traditional rape, but you talk about young black and brown queer boys who oftentimes find themselves in relationship with older men, sometimes older white men, sometimes other black and brown men. Can you talk a bit about what you examined in your rape documentary and what you've come across in terms of talking about sexual violence and sexual assault and those kinds of things, how those things might relate? Because I would probably gather that some of the same emotions, some of the same experiences that these young black and brown boys who fall victim to sexual predators, that those kind of emotions and experiences are mirrored in women who are victims of rape. And all, like you pointed out, oftentimes they are folks that you know and folks you trust. Can you maybe just talk a bit about how those things might relate, or maybe some thoughts as someone who's kind of studied this topic?
Yes, and thank you for asking the question. I think that what's really important is there is acknowledgement that sexual violence impacts all of us. It knows no boundary. I chose to look at how it impacts cisgendered women and girls, but it definitely knows no boundaries. And there is, I would offer, just another layer of silence that boys experience because of patriarchy, because of homophobia and heterosexism. And I think that the spaces, people don't want to address it because there's this kind of assumption. First of all, within queer communities, it's hard to address because it's what I often hear is, we don't want people to think that this is what we do. And I think that we really have to differentiate between, you know, predators and gay people who are living their lives. Now, yeah, there are some predators who are gay, and there are many predators who are straight. I think that what happens for anyone, and I'm just speaking as a queer woman who was molested as a child. Now, my molestation was a male perpetrator, but I think that this is what happens with boys, similar things in terms of just this notion of shame and blame. And then if we are queer, then we feel like we have to say, oh, no, that's not why I'm queer, because people are always trying to problematize our identity.
Certainly.
Because the belief is that normalcy is heterosexual.
Yeah.
So anytime that somebody hears that you're queer, then they want to go, oh, are you queer because you've been molested?
Yeah.
And it's like, no, I'm queer because I love women. Or if I'm a man, I'm queer because I love men. You know, and I'm attracted to them.
Mm.
I think that there are people who, most families, we don't want to deal with the trusted person. And I think that when it's same gender sexual violence, this is a whole nother layer, because to confront that means that we have to confront all these notions and ideals about what manhood is. So if people find out that their son has been molested or raped, it's like, oh no, I want him to be a man. And there is this kind of misogyny that gets fed into when boys are violated against, because that is something that's supposed to quote unquote happen to girls. And so I think that there's just so much shame and blame. And at the same time, I want to say, because that I just observed how so many people were like going rushing to defend.
Certainly. Don't get me started.
Sandusky,
Kevin Klassen,
and just so many male perpetrators, regardless of who the victim survivors are. But when it's same gender, and we can see this with priests, there's just another layer that's going on there, because there's something about it that's supposed to be more sick, quote unquote, than if it's heterosexual violence against girls. And so, and I think that we really need to, you know, look at how homophobia is intertwined with sexism, child sexual abuse, and that we have to, if we're not addressing these issues, that we continue to make children more vulnerable.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. I just wanted to follow up with, because I even find with my students that the idea of familial violence is something that we're not socialized to believe, that all of us are always fearful of this idea of a stranger that's going to attack us or assault us, and not conscious of maybe a family member or a family friend or someone that we know, right?
Right.
Could you speak to why you think this continues to be the kind of socialized messages that we get, and also the socialized message around particularly cisgendered girls and women, the message around how we need to stop rape, as if men have no part in that, and as if, you know, society has no part in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess that was a lot, but the first one, that was so much.
It's so important. I mean, I think this notion of that the rapist is the strange, unidentifiable man. We need to acknowledge that the perpetrators are male and female. We don't want to deal with the sobering reality that we know perpetrators. I think that that's really the truth of the matter, that we know and love perpetrators. If it's somebody out there, then we don't have to confront what is going on in our own intimate spaces, in our families, in our churches, in our mosques, in our communities. So I think that and then it becomes the monster, quote unquote. And I think that we have to understand that so many of us have been impacted by this, and so many of us have been perpetrated against and perpetrate. And I think that if we can begin to talk about these complexities and realities, then I think that we might be able to really begin to tackle this and move in a way in which people are held accountable. I believe in accountability, but I'm not convinced that sending somebody to jail for X amount of time that they send to jail without any kind of rehabilitation work is going to stop sexual violence. That's not going to work. In terms of blaming women and girls, and then just, you know, in the context of boys, because I saw this what's happening around just all the fallout from Elmo, right, was just this notion of like, oh, well, they're just going after him because he's rich. It's like there's just this knee-jerk reaction to not believe that violence has occurred. And particularly when you have been violated as a child. And so then we have to blame the quote-unquote fast girls. You know, like, look at how she's dressed, look at what's going on. You know, we really demonize, particularly how we demonize girls of color. It's just for everything. And so in so many instances, the girls who have been sexually assaulted, as I'm talking about children right now, that for them it's like they are acting out. A lot of times young people who are like acting out that we view, they're acting out because of what they've experienced and what they've witnessed. Mm-hmm. I think that as long as we keep putting the blame on the victim survivors, we are condoning rape. If I leave my computer in a coffee shop and everybody sees it and I just walk out and forget it, yes, it was dumb. But if somebody steals that computer and I can track it down, they would be held responsible for stealing my computer. Yeah. If I'm, you know, as a professor, if my students are plagiarizing, they will be expelled.
Yeah.
Okay, because they've stolen someone else's intellectual property. We have to ask ourselves, why are we so clear about the theft of material possessions, the theft of intellectual property? Why are we so willing to go to bat for that in ways in which we are not willing to go to bat for people's bodies?
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Aisha.
It's been a pleasure to have you. Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. This has been great.
What another wonderful show. Checking in with two phenomenal sisters doing really, really good things.
Yes.
What'd you think about the things we talked about today?
Well, I love talking to both Aisha and Gina. I love conversations that really elucidate the struggles, the interpersonal struggles that Black girls and women go through, particularly around issues of violence, domestic violence, sexual violence, molestation, rape. I love the fact that they are writing and making films and producing works that really create a spotlight around these, you know, very pertinent issues. I mean, those statistics in that interview are stark when it comes to the types of violence that Black girls and women experience on a daily basis.
And certainly I think that the Gina's commentary and her column were right on point in an issue that's really, really timely, but too often overlooked. So I'll give you an example. We have all these reality television shows like Basketball Wives, and you think of Evelyn Lozada, who is married to Chad Ochocinco, and they recently had this whirlwind romance, got married, shortly thereafter got divorced, and apparently there was an allegation of abuse. But again, folks are always saying, well, what did she do to drive him to punch her in the face? You know, or there's always... As, you know, and especially among, you know, when it comes to athletes and celebrities, you know, what did Rihanna do to drive Chris Brown to punch in the mouth?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that, you know, we have to do much more examination of what, first of all, drives people to be violent. Because outside of even intimate relationships, we have a problem with violence in this country. You know, and so the same ways that we view violence in platonic relationships, the same way we don't question why person A shot person B, doing a robbery, we also have to examine intimate partner violence in the same way, that the problem is the violence itself, despite what it may have driven someone to, you know, to such an act. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I challenge, you know, the sports fans and the stands of Chris Brown and all the superstar singers to really stop kind of figuring out what a woman did to drive them to violence and really start checking folks for the violence itself. So
I agree.
And of course, Aisha is someone that you've liked for a long time.
Yes. And since my time in Philadelphia, when I was in grad school, I met Aisha, and she was attempting to get the documentary off the ground. And it was, I mean, once it was completed, it was phenomenal. The first time I saw it was actually screened in Philly. And so I followed her work and her career, and now, you know, her writing with the Feminist Wire, it was of course phenomenal. And I really, really, really love the, you know, documentary itself, and for a number of reasons, most of which have to do with Aisha being very vocal around her own trauma, and her empowerment in that vocalization really has helped propel other young Black women to not be silent around what has happened to them. And you know, just like Gina was saying, the lack of the feeling that Black girls and women feel as if they cannot be vulnerable, they cannot be fragile, they cannot be victimized. And, you know, we're strong and, you know, emotionally, physically, that nothing happens to us. And the fact that, yeah, stuff is happening to us. In fact, it's happening to us, you know, 7 times more or 11 times more, at more significant rates and more, you know, every millisecond. And no really talks about this. And then Gina's article also talks about the traumatic realization for all of us that we live in a culture that systemically and institutionally perpetuates systemic sexism and misogyny, and somehow gives males in our culture and perpetuators of violence in our culture the license to murder or take down, as if it's somehow their right. And it's disgusting. And I for young people who want to still say, oh, Chris Brown is sad and he made a mistake, it's like, no.
Certainly, this is a topic that we can never have enough discussion about: violence in our communities, intimate partner violence,
rape
and sexual assault against women certainly needs to be continue to be examined. So we encourage you all, as our listeners, to Google both these women, find out what they're up to, and we invite you all to get involved in these conversations, not just with our show via our Twitter and Facebook, but also get involved in whatever kind of social networks you're involved in or message boards. So I will say that we've been very, very lucky. Our show has been on for a couple months now. We've been very lucky to have a phenomenal roster of contributors, both from the very beginning with a lot of our local friends, but also here lately with some really national figures who are doing awesome work. So certainly our appreciation to all of our new friends. And if you all stay tuned, we promise to bring you all much greater and cooler information. Was that conjugated correctly?
I love much, much greater.
I didn't know if I conjugated that
mo
correctly.
Mo better. We're going to bring you some mo better.
We're going to bring you a mo better show. So y'all stick with us. It only get mo better from here.
Okay, guys.
All right, y'all. Take care.
Okay, bye. Strange Fruit is produced by 89.3 WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Our producer is Laura Ellis. The views we and our guests express on Strange Fruit don't reflect those of WFPL, Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
For more information on Strange Fruit, go to WFPL.org, find us on Facebook, and visit us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod. I'm Jason Gardner.
And I'm Kyla Story. Thanks for listening.